We're examining the interaction between the world and the American church over the past several decades, and I have some moral issues, moral and philosophical issues that I have been asked to mention, and then we'll take some questions about them if you have them. But it has to do with several different areas: birth control, abortion, artificial insemination, test tube babies, surrogate mothers. There's a lot to say on these issues, but may not be quite as complicated as it might at first appear, especially if we keep as our polar star some biblical principles that I think we can nail down pretty well. The first one of the biblical principles I'd like for us to keep in mind as we discuss these things is human life and the value that God places on it. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. And in addition to the value of human life as distinguished from animal life, we also have the concept of the sacredness of the family, parents and children, as God views it. Marriage and parenthood is very important to him. So I'd like to talk about these subjects in the order that I mentioned them. First of all, birth control. Obviously, there are a lot of methods of contraception available in our time and place, but in Bible times, we didn't have all of those. Undoubtedly, the most common and virtually universal method of averting contraception in biblical times was simply withdrawal, so-called coitus interruptus. We have a number of lines of evidence for this, and I don't know if we need to present those or not, but I'll mention two or three lines casually, ways that we know that withdrawal was commonly practiced. One is based on the names of the temple prostitutes in Assyria and Babylonia. The meaning of those names indicates that withdrawal was practiced. Also in the Talmud, it is indicated that withdrawal was practiced to avoid pregnancy during the 24 months in which a child was nursed. There is a euphemism, meaning withdrawal, that was used to describe that. And also in the 38th chapter of the book of Genesis, we have the case of Onan in verses 8 through 10, which is the one clear example of withdrawal with contraceptive intent in the entire Old Testament. And I believe personally that the context there indicates clearly that Onan's sin lay in his selfish unwillingness to honor his levirate duty by raising up seed to his dead brother's name. We have the concept of levirate marriage, Old Testament and New. Remember when the Sadducees in Matthew 17 came to Jesus and said, "We had a man and a woman that were married, and the man died, and they were childless, so she married his next oldest brother, and he died, so she kept on till she married seven brothers out of the same family." This was the levirate marriage, and it's a very old concept. There were tremendous responsibilities that went along with this, and Onan did not take the responsibility. He was willing to marry his dead brother's widow, but then he perverted the institution. And I believe the passage in Genesis 38 is instructing us concerning the responsible use of sex, but does not forbid contraception per se. In light of the fact that contraception was practiced by withdrawal, we would expect to find a prohibition to the practice in the Bible if God considered it to be a sinful act, in view of the fact that so many sinful sexual acts are mentioned and are condemned. But we do not find that with regard to contraception. There are a couple of passages especially that we would expect to find it if God did consider it a problem. One of those is Leviticus chapter 15, verses 16 through 18, where the discussion is involving the emission of semen from the male body apart from intercourse, and this was not regarded as a sinful act there. There was no sacrifice required. There was no moral fault implied when this occurred. And this is likely, I think, referring to nocturnal emissions or wet dreams, as they're sometimes called. The laws regarding this are ceremonial and sanitary. This may even refer to things other than what I have described. In Leviticus chapter 20, a few chapters over, verses 10 through 21, we have a list of sexual crimes that are punishable by death. All of them involve intercourse with a person apart from marriage or intercourse with animals, but there's no reference to withdrawal as a sexual sin in that list. There are a couple of views of marriage that are extreme polar opposites from one another, and it's possible to hold either one of these. I don't think either one of them is biblical, though. One of them is marriage as a means, and the other is marriage as an end. Marriage as a means to an end, means that it's not of value as an end in itself. It's merely a means to an end. And it says that the primary purpose of marriage is the generation and rearing of children. Therefore, all other aspects of the marriage relationship must be viewed as contributory to the procreative process. This view makes every effort to discourage birth control, and although there are limitations on childbearing permitted by those who hold this view, they are preferably bisexual continence and also by the so-called natural rhythm method. But these limitations are regarded as exceptions, applicable generally only in cases of ill health or disease or poverty or circumstances like that. So that's marriage as means to an end, the end being children. The opposite view of this rose later in history. It's a very different kind of philosophy that has come about primarily in more modern times. This view was nourished by the courtly love tradition of the medieval period and then especially by the romantic movement of the 19th century, and it sees the union of a man and a woman not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. The attitude toward birth control arising from this view is easily predictable. Are you having trouble parking? Then try Planned Parenthood, used to be said on bumper stickers sometimes. That they would see no need for children in a marriage. In fact, children would get in the way of the marriage and the purpose for marriage, according to that view, marriage as an end in itself. When I try to answer the question, how does the Bible view birth control, I have to ask the question, how does the Bible view marriage? Because I think the answer to the first question is contingent on the answer to the second. The focal center of scriptural teaching on marriage is not found in the first two chapters of Genesis. Rather, it is found in the fifth chapter of the Ephesian letter, verses 22 through 32. Here we have quoted the first two chapters of Genesis, but we see it coming to the fruition here, and we see in the description of the wife first and her relationship to her husband, and then the husband and his relationship to his wife and the relationship that they have together, we see that children are not even mentioned in this. And this is the focal center of scriptural teaching on marriage. Children aren't even mentioned here. Understood in the light of its New Testament fulfillment, marriage cannot be regarded simply as a means to an end, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. But understood in the light of its New Testament fulfillment, neither can marriage be regarded only as an end in itself. They shall be one flesh. Rather, we have to take both of these ideas and bring them together. Marriage in the New Testament is seen as an analogy. Indeed, it is seen as the best human analogy of the relationship between Christ and his church. Paul connects husband and wife with Christ and the church with three as's and two just as's in just those 10 verses in Ephesians chapter 5. And then he concludes with the great summary statement, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." When and only when marriage is viewed as the type of which Christ and church is the antitype, can we avoid the extremes of marriage as means to an end and marriage as an end in itself. So to get more specific about this, Christ's relation with the church is a total love relation, not just a means to an end. So we must not view marriage simply as a procreative function. Where contraception can contribute to subduing the earth in order to achieve a better total human relationship, then it's not to be condemned. But on the other hand, neither is the human love relationship an end in itself. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Why is that? That's what the Lord said in answer to the Sadducees when they brought him that story about the woman with the seven men that she married as each one died. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Why? Because, to use a quotation from Paul that was for in another place and for another reason, when that which is perfect is come, that which is in part shall be done away. Now, I don't think the Apostle Paul was talking about heaven when he said that. I think he had something else in mind, but I think the principle of it applies here. And when that which is perfect is come, that which is in part shall be done away. In the full manifestation of the antitype, Christ and his church in heaven, then the type which was marriage, human marriage on earth between us here, that type is embraced and it disappears. And that's why in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, because there's one marriage in heaven, the marriage of the bride to the bridegroom. Thus the love relationship between husband and wife can never be absolutized as an end in itself. We must never make the mistake of living merely for each other when we're married. And to do that, it can be an extreme disaster. It's not good for the relationship at all for you to live merely for each other. Rather, you are yoked together like a couple of oxen pointing in the same direction, pulling the load in the same direction. But you're looking outward at the world. You're looking at the service that you can bring. The relationship of marriage is meaningful insofar as it reflects the Christ relationship. And apart from this, it can and does become idolatrous. In the light of the divine analogy of marriage, we can see the centrality of children to the marital union. Jesus did not just give himself up in death as an isolated deed, but he did this in order to bring many sons unto glory. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. Just as the union between Christ and his church does not exist for its own sake, but to bring others into spiritual rebirth, so the marital union is properly fulfilled in natural birth. So, to get to the question, how practically are Christian spouses to decide the birth control question? They decide it, I believe, within the framework of the analogy relationship. They're to consider it personally and prayerfully in the light of their own situation, physically, emotionally, financially, spiritually, and also in the light of the population situation in their area of the world, perhaps. The answer might not be precisely the same for people living in certain sections of India as it would be for people living in certain sections of Canada. But they will act responsibly, viewing marriage as neither a means nor an end, but as the great analogy of Christ's work of salvation. I do not encourage young childless couples who do not want children to have children. I do encourage young childless couples who do not want children to want children. And there's a big difference there. I encourage young childless couples who do not want children to want children, and when they want children, then I encourage them to have children. I don't want people who don't want children to have children. But the Apostle Paul did say, I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house in 1 Timothy chapter 5. And I take that to heart. We must do what we can to make our marriages evangelistic, both generatively and regeneratively. But I believe in the responsible use of birth control, I believe that's acceptable to God. But by saying that, I'm talking about contraception. By contraception, I mean whatever prevents the fertilization of the egg can, at least in some cases, be acceptable. On the other hand, whatever interrupts the pregnancy after the egg is fertilized is ending a life that has already begun. The abortion pill, morning after pill, RU486, methotrexate, whatever you want to call it, I believe would be wrong to use. And there has been a new language developed around this, blurring the line between contraception and abortion with words like contragestion rather than abortion, because they wanted to soften the idea. Sometimes there are a number of other birth control methods that may have this same kind of a problematic issue, like the intrauterine device, for example. Whatever results in the intentional death of an embryonic human being is wrong. James said in James chapter 2 that the body without the spirit is dead. But when we look at a fertilized egg, we see that it is not dead. It's got 46 chromosomes, 23 from the mother, 23 from the father. If it's not a living human being, then what is it? If it's not a living human being, then when would it become a human being if you left it alone? If it's not alive, then just leave it alone and it'll never be a problem to you. If the body without the spirit is dead, and this fertilized egg is not dead, then it must have a human spirit already, because the body without the spirit is dead. Yes, Wendy.
You know, about this idea of fertilization.
Yes.
Do you think in John 1:13, Revelation, what do you call it? John 1:13. Could that be the types of fertilization possible?
In the Gospel of John 1:13?
Yeah. Like that we have today.
Now, I think he's referring to spiritual things here in John 1:13.
And not the idea of embryonic fertilization and things like that?
Not in any physical sense.
Transplantation? Okay.
Not in any physical sense, yes. Thank you for that. Were there any other questions? Okay, John.
You may be going to get there, but were you going to discuss at all the various methods by which the birth control pill prevents a birth?
I don't know as much about that as you may speak.
Well, I do know it's not generally discussed, and it does have to do with the change of the meaning contraception. In 1976, there was an effort to change the idea of contraception, because prior to that, as you may well know, it had meant not permitting the fertilization of an egg, but it was changed so that it would permit the fertilization of the egg, but it wouldn't include the implantation of that fertilized egg, or the blastocyst, I guess as they call it. And the birth control pill does, and I know this is extremely controversial, but I'll just throw it out. The birth control pill does, if you look into it, and I would just encourage anyone to Google it who has curiosity and look it up, it keeps you from having a baby when it works through one of three methods, and one of those methods is if the egg succeeds in being fertilized, which it can, then it has affected the uterine wall so that the blastocyst cannot implant, which in turn then creates an abortion. So when we take that, or when it's used, we do run the risk of bringing about an abortion.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. I oppose anything that produces an abortion. Did somebody else say something?
I don't think that covers all of it.
Okay. We'll get this mic to you. Yeah, say it through the mic. When you say it without the mic, the people in the room can hear it. When you say it through the mic, the whole wide world can hear it.
There are many medications out here, and unless somebody here is a medical doctor, I think that we're probably beyond ground we should, you know, be talking to, unless you know exactly what the specific medications are. And I wouldn't want us to lead someone astray.
Okay.
So I think we better stick to...
Let's prove all things, hold fast that which is good. You have a suggestion of something to be read?
That's why I said I would encourage anyone to do the research. I think you will find that the medical profession is behind that.
Okay. Do you have a...
fact among them.
And you can Google it. You mentioned that. Do you have a specific...
I would encourage anyone to just look into it. Okay.
Okay. Right. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good, examine these things for yourselves. And if anybody has anything specific that should be read, feel free to mention that. Okay, let's proceed. I appreciate the exchange. I'm sorry. Tom Woody.
One of the important factors we have to keep in mind is what the 127th Psalm says. It says, children are a heritage from the Lord. You have to remember the part the Lord has in it. There are some couples that don't want to have children, and they get children. There's other couples that want children, and they don't get them. And so we've got to use our faith in this and do like you're saying, is take all these things into consideration when we make our decisions.
Thank you very much for that. There are some very interesting things in the very first chapter of Genesis. In the first chapter of Genesis, the word create is used three times, in verse 1, verse 21, and verse 27. In verse 1, it has to do with the bringing into existence of the physical elements. In verse 21, it has to do with the bringing into existence of animal life. And in verse 27, of course, in bringing into existence the human life. The word create in those verses is contrasted with the word make or made in verse 7, verse 16, verse 25, and verse 31. When we have create being used, it's a great leap that's being taken from one variety of thing to another. And then within those varieties of things, there are things that are made by God. He creates the matter, and then he makes planets and so forth out of it. So we have this third use of create referring to animal life. It shows the spiritual difference that makes man man. And in the ninth chapter of Genesis, we see that it's sinful to murder man, but it's all right to kill an animal and even to eat that animal. So we can see the difference of man, the difference of man and the difference it makes. That human life, and that's what we placed up here as we begin, human life is God-given, it's sacred, it's protected, and it is treasured. At the same time, we're relaxing the death penalty on hardened criminals in this country in the past few decades. We were also putting the death penalty on to babies whose only crime was being unexpected, unwanted, and unloved, killing them through techniques crueler than I can even describe, because we've been taught that we're animals and we act like animals. One of the most despicable of all acts is the murder of the helpless. In Proverbs 6, we see that six things are an abomination to the Lord, seven things are an abomination unto him, and one of those is hands that shed innocent blood. Just 3 weeks into our existence in the womb, we have a vascular system that has already developed after fertilization, producing blood. Even before the mother knows that she's carrying a baby, there's a vascular system producing blood in many occasions. But our senses have been stripped, we've lost our moorings, and we're no longer able to blush as a society. So we're adrift in a sea of relativism, and that's the reason for the popular acceptance of abortion. The Bible comments concerning unborn humans many times. Jeremiah 1:5, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. Before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." Would it have been wrong for Jeremiah's mother to abort him? What about the Apostle Paul? Separated from his mother's womb, would it have been wrong for Paul's mother to have aborted him? Would it have been sinful for the mother of Jesus Christ to have aborted him? She wasn't married, you know, but it certainly would have been sinful. It would have been sinful for John the Baptist's mother to have aborted him. David said in the 139th Psalm that thine eyes did see my substance within the womb. When yet there were none of these things that were developing, you could see them ahead of time. Psalm 139, verse 16. In the third chapter of the book of Job, miscarriage is placed in a category of other people that had died. There's a great deal in the Bible about this. God has a plan for us, and abortion destroys the work of God. We're to do all in the name of the Lord. How can an abortionist possibly do what he does in the name of the Lord as he's scraping human life away? I do not consider abortion acceptable under any circumstances, including rape, incest, or the mother's life being in danger. In 1979, I conversed with Everett Koop, who later became the Surgeon General of the United States, who told me that in 42 years of medical practice, he had never known of a case where abortion was necessary to save a woman's life. He said, take the baby out if you need to save the woman's life, but try to save the baby's life too, which is a difference in emphasis. The baby may die, but at least you're trying to preserve life rather than trying to kill it. He also said that maybe it does happen that in real rape cases there is pregnancy, but he said that number of cases is extremely small. That's what he said. The church can be a great help and should be a great help to somebody who has a baby and is not prepared to raise it. We said on day one that God has created something in the church which is greater than the sum of its parts. It is to be glorious. And the church can be a great help here and should be if we do have a young woman who is unmarried and finds herself through her own circumstances in this situation. The church can be a great help there. We can adopt, we can assist in a number of ways, but we must always teach against murder, which we have every reason to believe that abortion is. It's wrong whenever it's done, it's wrong wherever it's done, and therefore we must find acceptable alternatives to it and have faith in God. Now pertaining to artificial insemination, which through the past few decades has grown very rapidly. By artificial insemination, the simplest form of this, we mean, is when the husband's sperm is collected and inserted into the womb of the wife. This does not have the success rate that it might at first appear that it would, because many times the reasons for male infertility are caused by a combination of problems, not just the lack of the concentration of sperm. So this probably has a success rate of 20% or so in many cases, but it does have some success. But much more widespread and much more controversial than artificial insemination using the husband's sperm is artificial insemination using the sperm of an anonymous donor. It's estimated that somewhere over 1 million people have been conceived by this method, using the sperm of an anonymous donor. Lots of lesbians have and do use it. Lots of feminists have and do use it. Proud to have a child without a man. Several studies have indicated that artificial insemination with the use of donor sperm can be harmful to the family. There are instances where the wife becomes obsessed with curiosity about the donor. After all, she's carrying his baby for 9 months. She wonders about him. Maybe she saw a picture of him when they selected the sperm that they were going to use. He's still anonymous, but maybe she saw his picture, because you can pick the sperm, as I understand it, from a book that you look at, like kind of going to a beauty shop or something. You see these pictures of models that have the hairstyles, and you pick the hairstyle you want. So you look through these pictures of attractive young men and see whose sperm you want as your anonymous donor. Well, she's seen his picture. She may begin to think and even to fantasize about him. It's an interesting thing that, according to the information I have, very few couples ever repeat artificial insemination with donor sperm. Many do it one time. Seldom is it repeated. And at present, as I understand it, virtually none of the children know that they were born through this process. The psychologists try to keep it that way because they feel like the identity problems of such a child could be enormous or even devastating. And so then the parents are forced to live with a secret that they can't discuss within the family and never are supposed to openly discuss it. And this conspiracy of silence strains the relationships in the family. There is a slight risk as well that if the process of artificial insemination with donor sperm is used, and used a great deal, that half-brothers and half-sisters conceived in this way may marry each other. And in fact, at least one occasion that I know of, a doctor had to intervene to keep a marriage between half-siblings from occurring. They had no idea, either of them, that that's what they were. But the doctor knew the donor sperm had gone out in certain places and saw that these people were about to get married. There would be terrible genetic issues involved, or could be, and so it wouldn't even be legal. And there are a lot of legal nightmares that are connected with all of this. There have been cases of divorce, of husbands filing on the basis that the doctor who performed the artificial insemination with donor sperm had actually technically committed adultery with the wife and refused to pay child support because they'd say, that's not my child. Who is the legitimate father if donor sperm is used? Here's what I believe about artificial insemination. I believe artificial insemination using only the sperm of the husband may well be morally all right, because I regard it as a mere technological crutch. But I believe that artificial insemination using donor sperm is in violation of the marriage relationship and of the biblical meaning of parenthood. And I would feel that way even if the donor were an identical twin of the husband, even if he has exactly the same genes as the husband. I think the marriage union would still be violated there, because the marriage union exists between two individuals and not just between two sets of chromosomes. On to test tube babies, in vitro fertilization. Usually when this is practiced, there are a number of eggs, maybe a dozen or so eggs, removed from the ovary of the woman and fertilized at the same time. And then the one that seems to be the most viable, the one that's the healthiest, apparently, is selected for implantation, and the others are just washed down the drain. Here, then, we have human life being created in order to be destroyed. The only way I could even consider in vitro fertilization would be if we just fertilized one egg of the wife with her husband's sperm and then place it in that wife, that mother, to be brought to term. But as it stands, each child born by in vitro fertilization represents a dozen or so siblings who have been washed down the drain, and to me that's unconscionable. What about surrogate mothers? It's possible to mix the egg and sperm from any two people and put the fertilized embryo into any normal womb and thus have any final set of parents or any single person gain custody of the newborn infant. Here we have parenthood having nothing to do with biological relationship. We have the child ceasing to be a gift from God and becoming a commercial item. And we have parents as consumers choosing donors from photographs of attractive young men and women. Childbearing has never been intended as a means or as an end within itself, but as part of a larger plan. Parental responsibility begins at conception and does not end until the child is reared. A great part of that rearing is training that child for God's service. How can any Christian surrender his or her reproductive powers to another person, thus ignoring the responsibilities that are connected? And how could any Christian ask another person to premeditatedly do the same thing? I believe that maternal surrogacy is immoral and strikes at the very heart of Jehovah's plan for the home, and therefore must be avoided and opposed. Our little children, when we were raising them, had a little book. The name of the book was Who is My Mother? I've read that to Amber and all of our children. But it was a book about a little bird that hatches out in the nest when the mother happens to be away from home and therefore doesn't know who his mother is. But he wants to know. He has an identity crisis about it. So he goes around asking everybody, are you my mother? He goes up to the kitten and says, are you my mother? Goes to the hen and says, are you my mother? And the dog and says, are you my mother? He goes to the cow and the car and the airplane and the steam shovel and asks everybody, are you my mother? Well, what's the answer to that question? What's the answer for today's children who are brought into being in all these variety of ways? Is the mother the egg donor? Is the mother the womb owner? Is the mother the woman who is married to the father? Just who is the mother? The idea of surrogacy did not work for Abraham and Sarah, and all of us should be able to learn from that. It seemed like a good idea at the time. At least it seemed like a good idea to Sarah. I don't know if it seemed like a good idea to Abraham or not, but he went along with it. Although he had no word from God on the issue, he had the word of Sarah. And it got the whole family into trouble. It messed the family up. The children weren't getting along. The women weren't getting along. It was a terrible mess and a terrible idea. It didn't work then, and it's not a good idea today either. At the bottom line of many of these issues is one truth. Just as Woodrow Wilson wanted to make the world safe for democracy, there are many today in America who want to make the world safe for fornication. And a lot of the things that we have going on are based on that principle, to make no accountability where sexual pleasure is involved. We don't need another Adolf Hitler to defame human dignity. All it takes is the promise of sexual pleasure without responsibility, and many people are ready to murder millions of babies every year through abortion. All it takes is the promise of a financially secure retirement, and a lot of people are ready to euthanize grandma and grandpa so that money doesn't go for health care, it goes for their retirement. All it takes is the promise of a few dollars, and a lot of men are ready to donate their procreative powers to a sperm bank. All it takes is the promise of a physically perfect child, and many people are willing to wash human zygotes or embryos down the drain after the fittest one is implanted into the uterus. All it takes for some women to rent their wombs. in order to bear somebody else's child is the right price. We don't need another Adolf Hitler to commit atrocities. These are atrocities in themselves. And the response of the church to these kinds of issues is the same as the response of the church to other moral and social issues, and that is preach the word. Be instant in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. The mission of the church is not one of social reform, but of spiritual reform. Our mission is educational, not activist. We use our time and our energies for actively teaching God's revealed knowledge for mankind, not trying to pass laws to force people to live in a way that they don't want to live. We are genuinely concerned about the way society is going, but our message stresses personal responsibility and personal thinking. Change, in order to be sincere and effective, has to be based on personal conviction. And so we help individuals to change their thinking and change their lives one by one. All these Bible studies we have throughout the communities in people's homes are based on that principle and that prospect, changing the world one life at a time through the preaching of the gospel. Society is automatically benefited by this influence over time. We help individuals to change their lives one by one. And then spiritual regeneration secondarily results in social reformation. The church was not given the charge to go out and try to reform the Roman society in the first century. And if she'd tried that, she would have been sidetracked. Jesus makes that very clear. As the church proclaimed the message of Christ, hearts were swayed by the power of the gospel, and social reforms followed after that. James chapter 3, verse 9. Reminds us that what Moses said of man is still true. We're made in the image of God, and we possess intrinsic value. And while it's certainly true that there are numerous physical aspects of marriage and the home, the ultimate thrust of the home is spiritual. If you are a Christian and are unmarried, you only have a right to marry a Christian. You do not have a right to marry a non-Christian. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. If you're a Christian and you're going to marry at all, marry a Christian. Now, if you're not a Christian, then you have a right to marry someone who's not a Christian. But if you are a Christian and you choose to marry a non-Christian, don't ask me to marry you. Be not unequally married, yoked together with unbelievers. The ultimate thrust of the home is spiritual, and we must be yoked together with someone who is spiritual. It's an earthly arrangement to enhance our heavenward journey. So let's make decisions with which we know God will be pleased. Now I'm ready for any comments or questions that you might have. Charles Engel.
What do you think about, as far as you're talking about adopting and so forth, as far as options the church could offer?
As far as what?
As far as what the church could offer, yes, in situations like that. This goes with that, and as well as custody issues. For a Christian, would it be right for them to voluntarily adopt out their children to someone else, or... it has ramifications in custody issues, too, that for a Christian to give up custody to a partner who has possibly left the church or denied the faith or whatever, what's the responsibility of that parent to those children in a divorce situation?
Okay, excellent question. I think that giving custody to somebody who's not a Christian would be a last resort. And I have personally, as I think of it, I don't think I have personally ever known of a case where we had an unwed mother who wanted to adopt her baby out. I don't believe I've ever personally known of a case where we could not find somebody in the church somewhere who not only would take that child, but who actually wanted that child and would take it and raise it. And sometimes this was done anonymously, so the mother didn't even know who had the baby. Sometimes the mother did know who was raising the baby. But I don't believe I've ever known of a case where we could not find a Christian home that was willing to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. while keeping themselves unspotted from the world. I'll go a step further with that. I cannot ever remember a time when Christian parents were killed in an automobile accident, for example, when we could not find a place for those children to go. There was always a Christian family that was willing to take them and complete the process of raising them. And that's exactly as it should be. These are some of the, the people that take these babies are some of my great unsung heroes. I guess because I just think it would be so difficult to do that. I think to take those babies and try to raise them, I don't know. We tried to raise three, and that was very difficult. And that's not my strong suit, I guess. And I just have the profoundest respect and love for the people that take these little children in. You've seen Brad and Nancy Rankin with those four little children. The church ought to support this type of thing to the hilt in every way that we possibly can. Those children are just thriving under their care. And that's just one example. There are other examples represented right here. It is such a wonderful thing. It's heartwarming, and we need to try to continue to support this in every way that we possibly can, and consult with these people occasionally, ask how they're doing, maybe do some babysitting or give them money, whatever it needs to support that process while those children are in those homes. Did I answer everything or not? Okay.
My responsibility as a father, can I just voluntarily, not because of forced situations like the death of the parents or whatever, can I as a Christian voluntarily hand my responsibility to raise my children to another Christian? And two, if I was going through a divorce and custody battles were going on and so forth, and my partner was not a Christian, what's my responsibilities to my children in that situation as far as custody, as far as raising them to know God, so forth?
Yeah, okay. As I said at the beginning, I think that to allow custody to somebody who is not a Christian would be a last resort for me. I couldn't see myself doing that. But you were also asking to another Christian? Okay. That would be, I guess, the next to the last resort. If I could possibly raise them myself, then I believe I should, and I would want that kind of control over the input that they had into their minds as they were growing up. But I can see some circumstances when the case of an unwed mother might be one, where she cannot give that child what every child needs. And that's a father and a mother and a family. She may not be able to do that for all kinds of reasons, and so I can see her, out of love for her child, giving that child up to a Christian home where she knows the child is more likely to be able to receive what it needs. Even though she does have a responsibility there, I think she can fulfill her responsibility by placing that child where it can have what she can't give it. Did you want to talk about that as well?
I just think that becomes...
I don't know. Oh, there he is. Oh, okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I just think that becomes, right now in our society, is becoming an incredibly difficult situation as divorces occur that involve people in the church and so forth. And child, they have children that are minors, and you know, the courts are not involved in parenting, but unfortunately involved in naming who's going to be the parenting, and it puts a Christian in an extremely difficult situation if they are forced by the courts to only have a minimal parental right when God, in my opinion, gives them a great deal of responsibility for the child, and it sets a Christian, I think, in a precarious position with the courts, I think, and that's why I was interested in what your opinion was about that, about how much you can fight and how much you can cooperate, and et cetera.
Stay out of court if you possibly can. You're not at home there. You're the only one there who can't lie. And the judges get so jaded that they often aren't really thinking through the process, and amazingly, inept assignments are often made. I've seen that firsthand. So we need to keep our marriages strong in the first place and not get into that situation. But if we're placed in that situation through no fault of our own, then we simply have to do the best we can. and work within the system. But it is a shame and a disgrace. Tom.
First, I want to commend you, Rick, for the way you've handled this whole situation.
Thank you.
And I certainly say amen to what you said about Christians not marrying outside the church. I have stood for that same position for 60 years. I have refused to officiate weddings within my own family because of those who wanted to marry outside the church. One thing concerning all these sins, but back to the subject of abortion, for example, we need to remind people that it is a forgivable sin, but it is a very emotional thing. I think I have seen more grief over a lady repenting of abortion. I think I've seen more grief over that than someone that's committed murder. I have dealt with lots of people down through the years. And one of the most difficult things is for a woman to ever forgive herself for having an abortion.
I agree completely, and I've seen it many times. I appreciate your words there. In trying to prepare for these sessions, I went back and reread To Heaven Bound Youth. What year did you put this out?
I don't know.
I don't know either. But I remember just right after Tom put out this little booklet, To Heaven Bound Youth, he came and held a meeting in Raytown when we were over in our other building on 63rd Street. And there was a stack of these sitting up on the table in front, and the young people could take them. I was sitting with some of the boys on the front row there. And Tom had been rather roundly criticized for some of the direct statements that he made in this little book. So he came up one evening before services and just sat behind us in the second row and told us, and I must have been, well, I couldn't have been very old because it was the old building. Maybe we were 10 or 11 years old. And he said, now, boys, there may be some things in that book that you shouldn't read yet because it's written for young people a little older than you are. And he's trying to be sure that we didn't get into something that we shouldn't be into yet. So, of course, I went right home that night after church and read. Read every word. And I thank you for it. Thank you, Tom. Who we got, Dennis?
I just wanted to echo what Tom had said.
Rachel. Congratulations.
Thank you. I just wanted to echo what Tom had said. I've, known unfortunately, a couple of young women who had abortions. And one in particular, she to this day really has not forgiven herself. And I think we also should be able to point scripturally to help them through that.
Amen.
Because they don't think that, I've done this awful thing. How could God ever forgive me?
Right. Absolutely true. And this is especially heartrending when at the time they had the abortion, they believed in it. They believed it was all right. They just didn't know any better. And, of course, the people at Planned Parenthood or elsewhere very often are very encouraging of them doing this, that this is the way to go. You're making the right decision. There's nothing to worry about. And then only later do they recognize the enormity of what they've done, and it is a great grief. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Rachel. Jennifer.
This is a slight tangent. Well, it is a tangent. But what would you say to an unmarried woman who has a desire to adopt a child, knowing that she cannot give this child a father to complete the circle?
Well, it's certainly not the ideal situation, but I would not oppose it in every case, because in some cases I see it as a step up from where that child already is. And although single-parent adoption it's not the whole answer, it's a better answer than some of the states that the children are in, and we have to go with the concrete better rather than seeking the ideal good at times. Did you have a thought on that, Jennifer?
Considering I was...
Exactly.
That was exactly the case I was under, and all this time I have missed having a father.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. So...
I don't blame you. We're talking here today on my dad's birthday, and he was very important to me. So I appreciate those words. Thank you for that. I'm not sure who's next, Dennis. I've seen a whole bunch of hands, and your guess is as good as mine on order.
I unfortunately, too, know of some people that have been in the situation. Young men, young ladies often make mistakes, and they're not often old enough to make good decisions on their own. And so they rely on their parents, and in both cases I know of as the parent that really kind of encouraged it and took them to Planned Parenthood. And not only did they have the grief in later years for what they did, they also had some resentment, I guess, feeling pressured into it from their yeah. parents. And that whole relationship between the parent and the child was affected too. And
absolutely. This is why, and I talked a bit about this downstairs a while ago, and tried to really emphasize it's so much easier in every way if we just do it God's way in the first place. And just, by the way, I love having your children. They are respectful, they are courteous, and they seem to have a genuine sense of devotion to our Heavenly Father, which I know must be there because you have instilled it in them. I haven't been able to say this about every group of young people we've had through the years, but the kids in the basement are really a terrific bunch of people, as far as I can tell. So I commend you for your part in that. Thank you very much, Tom. Tim.
Rick, you mentioned the relationship between couples. What came to my mind was, have you had any experience with the legal ramifications of whether somebody was married by certificate, state certificate, or covenant? I ran across an article here
not too much,
a couple weeks ago.
To me, every marriage is a covenant, so I don't make a distinction there.
Well, I had a friend who got married, and he, before covenants became as popular as they are now, and he told me the reason he got a covenant was because he would own his children and the state would not be able to intervene in the event there was a contingency with he and his wife.
I'm not familiar with the legalities of all
that. I wonder
if
you had any experience with that.
I've not enough to comment on it. Sorry. There's the guy with the good comment. Key.
Two comments, Rick. I appreciate the fact that when you touched on Ephesians 5, you mentioned the idea of it was a husband and wife considered in the marriage and in the family. And Tamara and I were infertile for a number of years. And it was amazing to us at the number of brethren who considered us not a family because we did not have children. This is something that put a tremendous amount of pressure on us and on our relationship. Mm-hmm. We survived, we thrived. But not every couple would perhaps have the same resolve that we had. Secondly, in terms of technological assistance, we also went that way for a while. We were very thankful that our doctor was proclaimed and professed a belief in God. And he said from the outset, you have absolutely no idea the toll that this will take on your relationship. If I decide that you have reached the point where you can no longer, where your relationship is in danger, we will stop no matter what you want to do. I will not go any further. You have two phrases written up on the board, human life and family. My advice is simply this. Do not let the quest for human life break apart your family.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, and I can't add anything to it. Again, I don't know who's next. We've got him front and back. Got John or Mike, and Mike, John, Wendy, and I didn't see over here.
It seems that there is a trend as societies become more affluent, assuming there are no other interferences, that they have fewer children.
Yes.
Almost the reverse of what things logically should be, that people who are richer should be able to have larger families. It seems the reverse is that you want to comment on why that is, or should that be?
I think it was we addressed it the first day when we talked about the mindset shift that prosperity brings. And we've seen this numerous times throughout history, and it's not unusual at all. It's a part of what Malcolm Muggeridge called the death wish of Western civilization, and he traced that historically as well. But there is that tendency to when people it would seemingly be unable to afford it, that they would have lots of children, and when they could afford as many children as they could have, that they would be often be childless or have only one or so. It's a natural tendency based on the shift that comes in people's thinking based on prosperity. I don't think it should be that way. I don't know why it would be that way, but it seems to be a natural human tendency. And there's probably more to it than I know about, but it's often been noticed. And I think it becomes a fashionable thing that as our houses get bigger, our families get smaller. I don't completely understand it. Did you want to comment on that?
No.
Okay.
At some point, I think it might be something we should teach on more.
Maybe we should try to figure it out. John, did you have something?
No.
Okay. Amy has something.
Just a second. They've been talking more in the classroom and stuff. What I've been listening to is they're saying it's because of population. They don't want to keep the population down, so they're saying to have less children is more profitable for the country.
Yeah.
So that's the question.
Well, I think, and I forget what year it was, but around 1970, 68 or 70, Paul Ehrlich came out with the book called The Population Bomb and put this idea into a lot of people's minds who had never thought of it before. I don't think it ever was true that the Earth was threatened by what we were doing populationally. As a matter of fact, you go drive in the western part of the United States, and it doesn't look like we're running out of space to me. Or the north part, or, you know, all over the place. There's space everywhere. And we know how to irrigate. We know how to raise lots of crops. If we'd quit bombing each other, we could have twice the number of people. Somebody told me one time, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that the population of the Earth could be put in Texas and live and still have space to live. I don't know if that extreme of an example is true, but I think it's probably close to being true. And the Earth is not threatened by the human population of the Earth. We do need to handle our resources well. We need not to waste. We need to recycle and use everything well, yes. But the Earth is not threatened by the population of the Earth. There are other agendas driving this type of thinking. But, yes, when a civilization begins to think that way, it becomes a part of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, a part of the supposed wisdom of the times. And that does contribute to what Mike was asking about, yes. Thank you, Amy. That's very good. Wendy.
To talk about what Charles asked about custody cases and what you stated, Rick, about having to tell the truth in court and the moral implications of that, I wanted to share a praise testimony of a sister that's in our church in Israel. She's a Messianic believer and had to file for divorce. And as the proceedings went on, the judge, we have a rabbinical court and we have a civil court, and both courts have to agree before anyone can get a divorce. It usually takes about 12 years to get a divorce. And she was given the option. Her husband decided to use her faith against her keeping her son. And she was put up with the decision of whether to deny Jesus and not raise her son as a believer or lose her son. And so she told them in court, both courts, that she would never deny Jesus and she would raise her son as a believer. And after many years, they awarded her son to her.
Good. That's as it should be. Yes, we cannot deny the Lord. I mean, it would have been easy for the people at the altar who knew they were going to be killed if they denied the Lord to say, well, if I just pretend to deny the Lord, then I'll be able to live a long time and convert a lot of people. But they didn't do that, and it would have been wrong for them to do it. I'm, again, sorry to cut our... Oh, okay, as long as you want to go, I'll go.
You know, all these sins we've been talking about tears at your heart. You think, well, this takes place in a third world country, an uneducated people, but surely not in our country. And then you say, well, it's taking place in the church.
All these things are issues in the church. Thank you, Milford, and thank you all.